Disc 7.
70. Inside Lucy's office, a light begins to flash on a computer. The news has hit the wire service. The infamous trial lawyer Rocco Caggiano appears to have committed suicide in a hotel in Poland, his body discovered by a maintenance worker who noticed a foul odor coming from one of the rooms. How in the hell? Lucy strikes a key to deactivate the flashing light. She clicks the mouse on print. Search engines are her specialty, and a posse of them have been dedicated to finding any information that might be related to Rocco Caggiano. There is plenty. Rocco loved to read about himself, was a news hog, and every time Lucy has scanned some article about him or a client he represented, she has felt an uneasiness she has never experienced before. She can't muster enough self-control to stop imagining Rudy helping Rocco shoot himself in the head. Point it up. The barrel should be pointed up. A tip she learned from her aunt Kay, whose reaction Lucy can't imagine were she to find out what her precious niece and Rudy have done. Not even 48 hours. Rudy leans over her shoulder, his breath on her neck, smelling like the cinnamon gun he has a habit of smacking away on when he's not in public. Sounds like our luck has continued to turn bad in Szczecin, thanks to a maintenance worker and a stuck drain. Lucy continues reading an AP report. Rudy sits next to her and leans an elbow on the desk, his chin in his hand. He reminds her of a boy who has just lost his first Little League baseball game. After all that planning. Fuck. Now what? You pulled up the medical examiner's report? Christ, don't tell me it's in Polish. Hold on, let me jump out of this, she clicks the mouse, into something else. I love Interpol. The last precinct is a very select client, one of those entities considered part of Interpol's massive international web. For the privilege, Lucy must pass security clearance, of course, and pay the same yearly subscription fee as a small country. She executes a search, and Rocco Caggiano's death records are on the screen in seconds. Police and autopsy reports have been translated from Polish into French. Oh, no, Lucy says with a sigh as she swivels around in the chair and looks up at Rudy. How's your French?
You know how my French is.
Limited to my tongue. You're so vulgar. Just a single-tasking computer. You boys. One thing on the mind.
I don't always think about only one thing.
You're right, I apologize. You think about the one thing, except you do it 2, 3, 1,000,000 times a day.
And you, Mademoiselle Farinelli?
Oh, God, your French is bad. She glances at her watch, this one a formidable titanium Breitling that includes an emergency locator transmitter, or ELT.
I thought you weren't supposed to wear that thing unless you're flying.
Rudy taps her watch. Don't touch it, you'll set it off, she teases him. He holds on to her arm, studying the watch, frowning at the bright blue face, tilting his head this way and that, pretending he's stupid. Lucy starts laughing.
One of these days, I'm going to unscrew this big knob right here, he taps her watch again, still holding on to her arm, and pull the antenna all the way out, and then run like hell.
Lucy's cell phone vibrates, and she slips it out of the case on her belt.
And laugh my ass off when the Coast Guard, the F-15s, come roaring in.
Yes, she bluntly answers the phone.
You have such a sweet manner with people, Rudy whispers in her ear. If I die, will you marry me?
Static on the other end is bad. Who is this? She asks loudly. I can't hear you. The static gets worse. Lucy shrugs and ends the call. Don't recognize the number, do you? She holds up her phone, showing Rudy the number that someone just used to call her.
Nope. 936? What area code is that?
Easy enough to find out. It doesn't require special search engines or Interpol to type in a telephone number and find out whose it is. Lucy logs on to Google. The name that comes up on the computer screen is the Texas Department of Criminal Justice, Polunsky Unit. Included is a map.
You didn't answer my question, Rudy says,
still flirting but completely cognizant of the importance of a call from Polunsky.
Why would I marry you if you're dead? She mutters, scarcely listening to him. Because you can't live without me.
I can't believe this. She stares at the screen. What the hell is going on?
Get Zack to call my aunt. Make sure she is safe. Have him tell her it's possible Sean Dunn might be out.
God damn it! He's fucking with us.
Why don't you call her yourself? Rudy puzzles.
That piece of shit is fucking with us.
Her eyes blaze. Why don't you call Scarpetta? Rudy asks again. Lucy instantly becomes somber.
I can't talk to her right now. I just can't.
She looks at him.
How are you doing?
Awful, he says.
71.
Benton did not call on a landline because he did not want the inaudible conversation taped. The technical tools that Lucy most likely has and can't live without would not include a cell phone that automatically tapes a live conversation, especially since very few people have her cell phone number, and those who do are not the sort she would secretly tape. This ploy was far simpler than the last one, and there is no risk that Lucy can try voice analysis to decipher what Jean-Baptiste's nonsensical taped voice had to say, which was nothing. Benton simply spliced fragments of Jean-Baptiste's taped voice with static to give the impression of an attempt to talk when one is in a very bad cell. Already she will have traced the call, just as she did the last one, to Polunsky. She will have no satellite capabilities because the garbled call is gone, lost in space, again because Benton did not call any of her office lines. She will be angry. When she gets sufficiently irritated, nothing can stop her. Jean-Baptiste Chandon is fucking with her. This is what she will think, and Benton knows Lucy well enough to be certain she has made the mistake of hating Chandon. Hate interferes with clear thinking. She will wonder how Sean Dunn can be calling her from Polunsky and from New York if her satellite technology is to be trusted. In the end, Lucy always trusts her technology. A second call from Polunsky, and now she will begin to believe, seriously believe, that Sean Dunn must have a phone with a Texas Department of Criminal Justice billing address. She is no more than a breath away from believing that Jean-Baptiste Sean Dunn has escaped. Scarpetta will decide she must encounter him face to face, behind protective glass, inside the Polunsky unit. Sean Dunn will refuse to see anybody else, and that is his right.
Yes, Kay, yes. It's for you. Please, face him before it's too late. Let him talk.
Benton is getting frantic.
Baton Rouge, Lucy! Sean Dunn said Baton Rouge, Lucy! Are you listening to me, Lucy?
72.
A radio with a dipole antenna is not required for Jean-Baptiste Chandon to know the breaking news.
Hey, hairball, Beast yells. You heard? Guess not, since you don't got no fucking radio like I do. Guess what? Guess what I just heard? Your lawyer ate his gun in Poland.
Jean-Baptiste carefully moves his pen with the skilled hand of a surgeon, tracing over the words on death row and on the front row of life. He brushes his fingertips over the indentations on white paper as he composes a letter to Scarpetta that will be forwarded to her by his lawyer, who now, Jean-Baptiste learns, is supposedly dead. If Rocco is dead, Jean-Baptiste has no emotions about it, but he is curious to know whether the death is significant or simply a random suicidal whim that carried Rocco away. The news of the suicide creates an uproar of the usual obscenities, cruel remarks, and questions.
Information.
On death row, information is precious. Anything new to hear is devoured. The men are starved for rumors, gossip, information, so this is a big day for them. None of the inmates ever met Rocco Caggiano, but whenever Jean-Baptiste's name has been mentioned on the news, Rocco has been mentioned too, and vice versa. A simple deduction is enough for Jean-Baptiste to accept that Rocco's death is of interest to the press, only because he represents the notorious Jean-Baptiste, alias Le Loup-Garou, alias Hairball, Mini-Me Dick, and Wolfman, and, oh, what was the newest appellation that Beast, the ever-clever Beast, conjured up earlier today? Pubic Enemy Number 1.
He wrote it on a folded note that was slid under Jean-Baptiste's door, complete with a pubic hair, Beast's pubic hair. Jean-Baptiste ate the note, tasting the words, and blew the pubic hair out his barred window. It drifted to the floor outside his cell.
"If I was Wolfman's lawyer, I'd eat my gun, too," Beast calls out.
Laughter and the bang-bang of inmates kicking their steel doors.
"Shut up! What the hell's going on in here?"
The mayhem doesn't last long. Corrections officers restore order to the pod immediately, and a pair of brown eyes appear in the barred window of Jean-Baptiste's door. Jean-Baptiste feels the low energy of the stare. He never stares back.
73.
"You need to make phone calls, Chandon?"
The voice belonging to the eyes asks.
"Your lawyer's dead. Committed suicide. They found his body in a hotel room in some Polish city I can't pronounce. Looks like he's been dead a while. Killed himself because he was a fugitive. Figures that you'd be represented by a criminal. That's all I know."
Jean-Baptiste sits on his bunk, tracing over words on white paper.
"Who are you?"
"Officer Duck."
"Monsieur Canard."
"Coin, coin. That is French for quack, quack, Monsieur Duck." "You want to make a phone call or not?"
"No, merci."
Officer Duck is never sure how to describe or define the subtleties that ignite his temper every time Jean-Baptiste speaks, but the result is belittlement and powerlessness, as if the mutant murderer is superior and indifferent to death row and those who have complete control of him. The Wolfman manages to make Officer Duck feel as though he is nothing but a shadow in a uniform. He looks forward to Jean-Baptiste's execution and wishes it could be painful.
"Got that right. No mercy's what your ass is gonna get in 10 short days,
Officer Duck mouths off.
"Sorry about your lawyer's blowing his brains out and rotting inside a hotel room. I can tell you feel real bad about it."
"Lies,"
Jean-Baptiste replies, as he gets up from his bunk and moves to the door, wrapping fingers with their swirls of pale downy hair around the iron bars in the tiny window. His Halloween face fills the space and startles Officer Duck, who almost panics at the close proximity of his inch-long, filthy thumbnail, the only nail that for some reason Jean-Baptiste never cuts.
"Lies,"
Jean-Baptiste repeats. It is never easy to know where his asymmetrical eyes are directed or how much they see, and the hair covering his forehead and neck and protruding in tufts from his ears overwhelms Officer Duck with fright.
"Move back. God damn, you stink worse than a dog that's been rolling around in the juice of something dead. We're gonna cut that fucking thumbnail of yours."
"It is my legal right to grow my nails and my hair,"
Jean-Baptiste replies softly, with a gaping smile that reminds the officer of a wide-mouthed fish. He imagines those widely spaced pointed baby teeth ripping into female flesh, biting breasts like a frenzied shark, while hairy fists pound beautiful faces to pulp. Chandon targeted only gorgeous, successful women with sexy bodies. He has a fetish for large breasts and nipples that, according to a forensic psychologist who is in and out of the pod, denotes an obsession with a body part that compels Jean-Baptiste to annihilate it.
"For some offenders, it's shoes and feet," the forensic psychologist explained over coffee perhaps a month ago. "Yeah, I know about the shoe thing. These wackos break into houses and steal some lady's shoes. It happens more than you might expect. The shoe itself is sexually arousing to the offender. Frequently, he then feels the need to kill the woman wearing the fetish or whose body part is the fetish. Many serial killers got their starts as fetish burglars, going into homes, stealing shoes, underwear, other objects that mean something to them sexually. So Wolfman was probably stealing bras when he was a hairy little kid. Could very well have been. He certainly enters homes with ease, and that is consistent with a serial burglar who has progressed to a serial murderer. The problem with fetish burglary is often the victim has no clue that her home has been entered and that anything was taken. How many women who can't find a shoe or even several shoes or lingerie would assume a burglar has been inside her home?"
Officer Duck shrugged.
Hell, my wife can't find nothing half the time she looks. You ought to see her closet. If anybody's got a shoe fetish, Sally does. But it's not like some guy can break into a lady's home and walk off with a breast. Well, I guess some of them are into the dismemberment thing. It's like hair color, eye color, or anything else. An offender has a fetish about whatever triggers sexual arousal that in some cases gives rise to a sadistic need to destroy that fetish. Which in this instance is the woman with the size and shape of breasts that are a fetish to Jean-Baptiste Chandon. Officer Duck understands, in a limited way. He likes breasts, too. He is perversely, shamefully aroused by images, even violent ones.
74. The ringing of the officer's feet on the catwalk fades. Jean-Baptiste resettles on his bunk, a stack of clean white paper on his lap. He taps his pen and composes another poetic phrase, unfurling it from his unique mind like a brilliant red flag that waves in rhythm with his pen. His soul brims with poetry, molding words into images and profundities that roll together in perfect rhythm is effortless, so effortless. Roll together in perfect rhythm. He traces his graceful calligraphy again and again, bearing down hard with the ballpoint pen. Roiling together in perfect rhythm. That is better, he thinks, tapping the pen on the paper again in rhythm with his inner rhythm. Tap, 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 tap. He can slow it down or make it faster or faint or strong, depending on the music of blood he remembers from each kill. Rolling, he starts again. Mais non. It all roils together in perfect rhythm. Mais non. Tap, tap of the pen. Dear Rocco, Jean-Baptiste decides to write, you did not dare to mention Poland to the wrong person. Of this I can be sure. You are too much of a coward. Tap, tap, tap. But who? Maybe Jean-Paul, he writes to his dead lawyer. Tap, 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 tap.
Hey, hairball, I got my radio tuned in, Beast yells. Oh, too bad you can't hear it. Guess what? They're talking about your lawyer again. Another itty-bitty little news flash. He left a note, see? It said having you for a client just killed him. Get it? Shut up, Beast. Get a life, Beast. Your jokes suck, man. I want to smoke. Why the fuck don't they let me smoke? Bad for your health, man. Smoking will kill you, dumb shit says so right on the pack.
75. The Atkins diet works fine for Lucy because she has never been keen on sweets and doesn't mind foregoing pasta and bread. Her most dangerous indulgence is beer and wine, and she abstains from both at Jamie Berger's penthouse apartment on Central Park South. I won't force you, Berger says, returning the bottle of Pinot Grigio to the top shelf of the refrigerator inside her beautiful kitchen of wormy chestnut cupboards and granite countertops. I'm better off without it myself. I can hardly remember anything any more as it is. I'd be better off if you would forget things now and then, Lucy says. I'd be a lot better off if I would, too. The last time she visited Berger's penthouse was at least 3 months ago. Berger's husband got drunk, and soon enough he and Lucy went at each other until Berger asked Lucy to please leave. It's forgotten, Berger says with a smile. He's not here, right? Lucy makes sure. You promised it was okay for me to come over. Would I lie to you? Well, Lucy kids her. For the moment, their light exchange belies the horror of that event. Never has Berger witnessed such a display in what was supposed to be civilized socializing. She truly worried that Lucy and her husband would resort to blows. Lucy would win. He hates me, Lucy says, pulling a packet of folded paper out of the back pocket of her cut-off jeans. Berger doesn't reply as she pours sparkling water into two tall beer glasses and goes back into the refrigerator for a bowl of freshly cut wedges of lime. Even when she is casual in a soft white cotton warm-up suit and socks, as she is now, she is anything but easygoing. Lucy begins to fidget, stuffs the papers back into her pocket. Do you think we can ever relax around each other, Jamie? It hasn't been the same.
It really can't be the same now, can it? Berger makes pennies as a prosecutor. Her husband is a real estate thief, maybe one notch more highly evolved than Rocco Caggiano, in Lucy's opinion.
Seriously, when will he be home? Because if it's soon, I'm leaving, Lucy says, staring at her.
You wouldn't be here right now if he was coming home soon. He's attending a meeting in Scottsdale. Scottsdale, Arizona. In the desert. With reptiles and cactus, where he belongs.
Stop it, Lucy, Berger says.
My bad marriage is not somehow related to all the awful men your mother chose over you when you were growing up. We've been through this before.
I just don't understand why.
Please don't go there.
The past is past, Berger sighs, returning the bottle of San Pellegrino to the refrigerator.
How many times do I have to tell you?
Yes, the past is past. So let's get on to what does matter.
I never said it didn't. Doesn't matter.
Berger carries their drinks into the living room.
Come on now. You're here. I'm glad you're here. So let's make it all right, shall we?
The view overlooks the Hudson, a side of the building considered less attractive than the front of it, which has the view of the park. But Berger loves water. She loves to watch the cruise ships pulled in and out by tugboats. If she wanted trees, she has told Lucy many times, she wouldn't bother living in New York. If she wanted water, Lucy usually replies, she shouldn't have bothered living in New York.
Nice view. Not bad for the cheap side of the building, Lucy says.
You're impossible.
That I know, Lucy replies.
How does poor Rudy put up with you?
That I don't know. I guess he loves his job.
Lucy sprawls on an ostrich-skin couch, her bare legs crossed, her muscles speaking their own language, responding to movements and nerves while she lives on with little awareness of how she looks. Her workouts are an addictive release from demons. 76. Jean-Baptiste stretches out on the thin wool blanket he soaks with sweat each night. He leans against the hard, cold wall. He has decided that Rocco isn't dead. Jean-Baptiste does not fall for yet another manipulation, although he is not certain what the purpose of this manipulation might be.
Ah, of course. Fear.
His father must lurk behind this lie. He is warning Jean-Baptiste that suffering and death are the reward for betrayal, even if the traitor is the mighty Monsieur Chandon's son.
A warning.
Jean-Baptiste had better not talk now that he is about to die.
Ha!
Every hour of every day the enemy attempts to make Jean-Baptiste suffer and die.
Don't talk. I will if I want. Ha! It is me, Jean-Baptiste, who rules death.
He could kill himself easily. In minutes he could twist a sheet and tie it around his neck and a leg of the steel bed. People are misinformed about hangings. No height is necessary, only a position, such as sitting cross-legged on the floor and leaning forward with all his weight, thus putting pressure on the blood vessels. Unconsciousness happens in seconds, then death. Fear would not touch him, and were he to end his biological life, he would transcend it first, and his soul would direct all that he would do from that point on. Jean-Baptiste would not end his biological life in this manner. He has too much to look forward to, and he joyfully leaves his small death row cell and transports his soul into the future, where he sits behind plexiglass and stares at the Lady Doctor Scarpetta, hungrily takes in her entire being, relives his brilliance at tricking his way into her lovely chateau and raising his hammer to crush her head. She denied herself the ecstasy. She denied Jean-Baptiste by depriving him of her blood. Now she will come to him in humility and love, realizing what she did, the foolishness of it, the joy she denied herself when she further maimed him and burned his eyes with formalin, the chemical of the dead. Scarpetta dashed it into Jean-Baptiste's face. The evil fluid demagnetized him briefly, and ever so briefly pain forced him to suffer the hell of living only in his body. Madame Scarpetta will spend eternity worshipping his higher state. His higher being will direct its superiority over other humans throughout the universe, as Poe wrote under the guise of a Philadelphia gentleman. Of course the anonymous author is Poe. The invisible agent, that is, the transcendent Poe, came to Jean-Baptiste in a delirium as he was restrained in the Richmond Hospital. Richmond was where Poe grew up. His soul remains there. Poe told Jean-Baptiste, "Read my inspired words, and you will be independent of an intellect you will no longer need, my friend. You will be animated by the force and no longer distracted by pain and internal sensations." Pages 56 and 57. The end of Jean-Baptiste's limited march of reasoning powers. No more diseases or peculiar complaints. The internal voice and glorious luminosity.
"Who's there?"
Jean-Baptiste's hairy hand moves faster beneath the blanket. A stronger stench rises from his profuse perspiration, and he screams in furious frustration. 77. Lucy slips the folded papers out of her back pocket as Berger sits next to her on the couch. "Police reports. Autopsy reports," Lucy tells her. Berger takes the computer printouts from her and goes through them carefully but quickly. Wealthy American lawyer, frequently in Szczecin on business, frequently stayed at the Radisson. Apparently shot himself in the right temple with a small-caliber pistol. Clothed, had defecated on himself. A stat alcohol of 0.26. She glances up at Lucy. "For a boozer like him," Lucy says, "that was probably nothing." Berger reads some more. The reports are detailed, noting the feces-stained cashmere pants, briefs and towels, the empty champagne bottle, the half-empty bottle of vodka. "It appears he was sick. Let's see," Berger continues. $2,400 in American cash inside a sock in the bottom drawer of a dresser. A gold watch, gold ring, a gold chain. No evidence of robbery. No one heard a gunshot, or at least never reported hearing one. Evidence of a meal. Steak, a baked potato, shrimp cocktail, chocolate cake, vodka. Someone can't pronounce the name. Working in the kitchen seems to think, but isn't sure, that Rocco had room service around 8 p.m. the night of the 26th. Origin of a champagne bottle is unknown, but is a brand the hotel carries. No fingerprints on the bottle except Rocco Caggiano's. Room was checked for prints. One cartridge case recovered. It and the pistol checked for prints. Again, Rocco's. His hands checked positive for gunshot residue, yada, yada, yada. They were thorough. She looks up at Lucy. We're not even halfway through the police report. What about witnesses? Lucy asks. Anybody suspicious? No. Berger slides one page behind another. Autopsy stuff. Heart and liver disease. Why am I not surprised? Arteriosclerosis, etc., etc. Gunshot wound. Contact with charred, lacerated margins and no stippling. Instantly fatal. That would make your aunt crazy. You know how she hates it when someone says that a person died instantly. Nobody dies instantly, right, Lucy? Berger peers over the top of her reading glasses and meets Lucy's eyes. You think Rocco died in seconds, minutes, maybe an hour? Lucy doesn't answer her. His body was found at 9:15 a.m. April 28th. Berger looks quizzically at her. By then he'd been dead less than 40 hours, not even 2 days. She frowns. Body found by, I can't pronounce his name, a maintenance guy. Body badly decomposed. She pauses. Infested with maggots. She glances up. That's a very advanced stage of decomposition for someone who's been dead such a short time in what sounds to me like a relatively cool room. Cool? The room temperature's in there? Lucy cranes her neck to look at a printout she can't translate. Says the window was slightly opened, temperature in the room 68 degrees, even though thermostat set on 74 degrees. But the weather was cool. Temperature low 60s during the day, mid-50s at night. Rain. She is frowning. My French is getting rusty. No suspicion of foul play. Nothing unusual happened inside the hotel the night Rocco Caggiano ordered room service. The alleged night, if the room service guy has the date right. She scans. A prostitute made a scene in the lobby. There's a description. That's interesting. I'd love to depose her. Berger looks up. Her eyes linger on Lucy's. Well, she says in a way that unsettles Lucy. We all know how confusing time of death can be. And it appears that the police aren't sure of the time and date of Rocco's last meal, so to speak. Apparently the hotel doesn't log room service orders on a computer. She leans forward in her chair, a look on her face Lucy has seen before. It terrifies her. Shall I call your aunt about time of death? Want me to call our good detective friend Marino and ask his opinion about the disruptive prostitute in the lobby? The description in this report sounds a little bit like you. Only she was foreign. Maybe Russian. Berger gets up from the couch and moves close to the windows, looking out. She starts shaking her head and running her fingers through her hair. When she turns around, her eyes are veiled with a protective curtain she keeps drawn virtually every hour of every day. The prosecutorial interview has begun. 78. Lucy may as well be shut off in a conference room on the fourth floor of the New York District Attorney's office, looking out dusty windows at old downtown buildings pressing in from all sides, while Berger sips her black coffee from her paper cup with the Greek key trim around the lip, just like she has done in every interview Lucy has ever watched. And she has observed many of them for many different reasons. She knows the noise and feel of Berger's shifting gears. She is intimately familiar with the modulations and revolutions of Berger's engine as she pursues, outruns, or hits the perpetrator or lying witness head-on. Now the mighty machinery is directed at Lucy, and she is both relieved and petrified. "You were just in Berlin, where you rented a black Mercedes sedan," Berger says. "Rudy was with you on the return flight to New York. At least I assume Frederick Mullins, supposedly your husband, was Rudy sitting next to you on Lufthansa and then British Air? Are you going to ask me how I know this, Mrs. Mullins?" "An awful alias. One of the worst." Lucy feels herself breaking down. "Well, in terms of names, I mean," she laughs inappropriately. "Answer my question. Tell me about this Mrs. Mullins. Why she went to Berlin." Berger's face is metallic, her eyes reflecting anger born of fear. "I have a feeling that the story I'm about to hear is anything but funny." Lucy stares at her sweating glass, at the lime sinking at the bottom of it, at bubbles. "Your return ticket stubs and the rental car receipt were in your briefcase, and your briefcase, as usual, was wide open on top of your desk," Berger says. Lucy's face remains expressionless. She knows damn well that Berger misses nothing and wanders at will in places she doesn't belong. "Maybe you wanted me to see it." "I don't know. I never thought I wanted you to see it," Lucy quietly replies. Berger stares out at a cruise ship slowly being hauled in by a tugboat. Lucy recrosses her legs nervously. "So Rocco Caggiano committed suicide. I don't suppose you coincidentally happened to see him while you were in Europe? Not saying you happened to be in Szczecin, but I do know that most people traveling to that part of northern Poland would be quite likely to fly into Berlin just like you and Rudy did." "You'd make a great prosecutor," Lucy says drolly, still not looking up. "I would never have a chance under your direct or cross. A scenario I don't want to imagine. Jesus. Mr. Caggiano, Mr. Jean-Baptiste Chandon's lawyer, former lawyer, dead. A bullet in his head. I suppose that pleases you." "He was going to kill Marino."
"Who told you that? Rocco or Marino?"
"Rocco," Lucy barely says.
She's in too deep. It's too late. She desperately needs to purge herself.
"Inside his hotel room," she adds.
"God,"
Berger mutters.
"We had to, Jamie.
It's no different than what the soldiers did in Iraq, you get it?"
"No, I don't get it."
Berger is shaking her head again.
"How the hell you could do something like this?"
"He wanted to die." 79. Lucy stands on the most beautiful Persian rug she has ever seen, one she has stood on many, many times during her better moments with Jamie Berger. They are far apart from each other in the living room. "It's hard for me to imagine you dressed as a prostitute and getting into an altercation with a drunk," Berger goes on. "That was sloppy work on your part."
"I made a mistake."
"I'll say you did." "I had to go back for my tactical baton," Lucy tells her.
"Which one of you pulled the trigger?"
The question shocks Lucy. She doesn't want to remember. "Rocco was planning on killing Marino, his own father," Lucy says again. "Next time Marino went on one of his fishing trips, Rocco was going to take him out. Rocco wanted to die. He did kill himself, sort of. Berger looks out at the city, her hands tightly clasped. He sort of killed himself. You sort of murdered him. Sort of dead. Sort of being pregnant. Sort of committing perjury. We had to. Berger doesn't want to hear this. She has no choice. We did, I swear. Berger remains silent. Here was a red notice. He was going to die. The Shanduns would have taken him out, and not in a nice way. Now the defense is mercy killing, Berger finally speaks. How is it different from what our soldiers did in Iraq? Now the defense is world peace. Rocco's life was over anyway. Now the defense is he was already dead. Please don't make fun of me, Jamie. I'm supposed to congratulate you, Berger goes on. And now you fucked me, too, because I know about it. I know about it. Berger repeats each word slowly. Am I stupid or what? Jesus, I just sat there, she whirls around and jabs a finger at Lucy, and translated those goddamn reports for you. You may as well have walked into my office and confessed to a murder and had me say, don't worry about it, Lucy, we all make mistakes. Or, it happened in Poland, so it's not my jurisdiction, it doesn't count. Or, tell me all about it if it will make you feel better. See, I'm not a real district attorney when I'm with you. When we're alone, when we're inside my apartment, it's not professional. 80. The fluid white as light and brilliant with sparks. Page 47. Who's there?
Jesus Christ.
Eyes flash in the barred window. Different eyes this time. Jean-Baptiste feels the heat of the eyes. They're nothing more than small, weak embers.
Shandon, shut up, goddammit. Shut up with this page number shit. Goddamn, I'm sick and tired of this page number shit. You hiding some book in there?
The eyes dart around the cell like sparks scattered by the wind. And get your filthy hand out of your pants, Mini-Me-Dick. That familiar, hateful laughter.
Mini-Dick, 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 Mini-Dick.
Beast is a voice from hell. Jean-Baptiste has been within 20 feet of Beast. That's how far away the barred window in Jean-Baptiste's door is from the indoor recreation area one floor below him. There is nothing to do during the 1 hour a death row inmate with privileges is allowed to spend on the rectangular wooden floor that is securely enclosed by thick wire mesh, like a cage at the zoo. Shooting hoops is popular, or simply walking a mile, which by Jean-Baptiste's calculations requires approximately 70 laps that no one but he is motivated to do. If Jean-Baptiste runs the laps, which is his habit during the 1 hour per week he is allowed recreation, he doesn't mind the other men on his cell block who leer out at him, their eyes small hot spots from sun shining through a magnifying glass. They make their usual insolent remarks. The recreation hour is the only opportunity inmates have to chat with and see one another from a distance. Many of these conversations are friendly and even funny. Jean-Baptiste is beyond caring that no one is friendly with him, and all fun is at his expense. He is familiar with every detail about Beast, who is not considered a model prisoner, but unlike Jean-Baptiste has privileges, including daily recreation and, of course, his radio. The first time Jean-Baptiste experienced every detail of Beast's presence was when two guards escorted Beast to the indoor recreation area, where he directed his diseased energy up to Jean-Baptiste's cell door. Jean-Baptiste's hairy face looked out the bars of his window. It was time to see. One day, Beast might be useful.
"Watch this, no nuts!"
Beast yelled at him, pulling off his shirt and flexing bulging muscles that, like his thick forearms, are almost black with tattoos. He dropped to the concrete floor and fell into one-arm push-ups. Jean-Baptiste's face disappeared from the barred window, but not before he studied Beast carefully. He is smooth-skinned, with a blaze of light brown hair that runs from his muscular chest down his belly and disappears into his groin. He is handsome, cruelly so, rather much like a swashbuckler with a strong jaw, large bright teeth, a straight nose, and intensely cold hazel eyes. He keeps his hair shorn close to his scalp, and although he appears quite capable of rough sex and beating his woman,
One wouldn't be likely to suspect that his preference is abducting young girls, torturing them to death, and committing acts of necrophilia on their dead bodies. In some instances, returning to the shallow graves where he buried them and digging them up for further acts of perversion until they are too decomposed for even him to stand it. Beast is called Beast not because he looks like a beast, but because he digs up carrion like a beast, and is rumored to have cannibalized some of his victims, too. Necrophilia, cannibalism, and pedophilia are transgressions that are repugnant to the typical violent offender on death row, who might have raped, strangled, slashed, dismembered, or chained his victims in a basement, to mention but a few examples. But violating children or dead bodies and eating people are serious enough offenses that a number of the inmates on Beast's cell block would like nothing better than to kill him. Jean-Baptiste doesn't bide his time imagining creative ways to smash Beast's bones or crush his windpipe. Idle fantasies for those who can't get closer than 10 feet to Beast. The necessity of keeping inmates separated is obvious. When people are sentenced to die, they obviously have nothing to lose by killing again, although in Jean-Baptiste's way of thinking, he has never had anything to lose. And with nothing to lose, there is nothing to gain, and life does not exist. References to those damned at birth are descriptive and dehumanizing, and in Jean-Baptiste's case, trace back as far as his earliest memories. Let's see. He thinks from his magnetizing metal toilet seat. He remembers being 3. He remembers his mother roughly ushering him into the bathroom, where he could see the Seine from the window, and inevitably at a very young age, connecting the river to bathing. He remembers his mother lathering his frail body with perfumed soap and ordering him to sit as still as a stone while she scraped baby-fine hair from his face, arms, neck, back, legs, feet, and on with his father's sterling silver-handled straight razor. Sometimes she would scream at Jean-Baptiste if she accidentally nicked his finger, or occasionally several fingers, as if her clumsiness was his fault. Knuckles in particular are very difficult. Madame Chandon's tremors and drunken rages put an end to her shaving her ugly son when she almost sliced off Jean-Baptiste's left nipple, and his father had to summon the family physician, Monsieur Reynaud, who coaxed Jean-Baptiste to be un grand garçon, as the little boy shrieked each time the needle flashed in and out of bloody flesh, reattaching the pale nipple, which dangled by a thread of tissue from Jean-Baptiste's downy breast. His drunken mother wept and wrung her hands and blamed le vilain petit monstre for not sitting still. A servant mopped up the little monster's blood while the little monster's father smoked French cigarettes and complained about the burden of having a son who was born wearing un costume de pingouin, a monkey suit. Monsieur Chandon could talk, joke, and complain freely with Monsieur Reynaud, the only physician allowed contact with Jean-Baptiste when he, the little monster, an espèce d'imbécile born in a monkey suit, lived in the family hôtel particulier, where his bedroom was in the basement. No medical records, including a birth certificate, exist. Monsieur Reynaud made sure of this and ministered to Jean-Baptiste only in emergencies, which did not include the usual illnesses or injuries, such as severe earaches, high fevers, burns, sprained ankles or wrists, a stepped-on nail, and other medical misfortunes that send most children to the family doctor. Now Monsieur Reynaud is an old man. He will not dare speak of Jean-Baptiste, even if the press will pay large fees for secrets about his notorious former patient. 81. Shame and fear overwhelm Lucy. She has told Berger in detail what happened in room 511 at the Radisson Hotel, but not who actually shot Rocco. Who pulled the trigger, Lucy? Berger insists on knowing. It doesn't matter. Since you won't answer the question, I'll assume you did. Lucy says nothing. Berger doesn't move as she looks out at dazzling city lights that give way to the darkness of the Hudson and become the flickering bright urban plains of New Jersey. The space between her and Lucy could not seem more impossible, as if Berger is on the other side of the expansive glass. Lucy quietly steps closer, wanting to touch the curve of Berger's shoulder, terrified that should she dare, Berger might fall from reach forever, as if she is supported by nothing but air, 45 floors above the streets.
Marino can't know, not ever, Lucy says. My aunt can't know, not ever.
I should hate you, Berger says.
She smells faintly of perfume, a strong scent, lightly applied, and it touches Lucy's thoughts that Berger didn't wear perfume for her husband. He isn't here.
Call it what you want, Berger continues. You and Rudy committed murder.
Words, Lucy replies. The casualties of war, self-defense, judicial homicide, home protection. We have words, legal excuses for committing acts that should be inexcusable, Jamie.
I promise you there was no joy in it, no delicious flavor of revenge. He was a pitiful coward, blubbering and sorry about only one thing in his entire cruel, worthless life, that it was his turn to pay the price. How could Marino have a son like that? What markers in the human genome came together to spew out Rocco? Who else knows?
Rudy, now you.
Anyone else? Were you given instructions? Berger presses on.
Lucy thinks about Benton's staged murder, about many events and conversations that she can never tell Berger. A tyrant of anguish and rage has ruled Lucy for years.
There are others involved, indirectly involved. I can't talk about it, really, Lucy says.
Berger doesn't know that Benton isn't dead.
Oh, fuck. What others?
I said indirectly. I can't tell you anything else. I won't.
People who give secret orders tend to vanish in the light of exposure. Are these your others? People who have given secret orders?
Not directly about Rocco.
She thinks about Senator Lord, about the Shandun cartel.
Let me just say that there are people who wanted Rocco dead. I just never had enough information to do anything about it until now. When Shandun wrote to me, he told me what I needed to know.
I see. And Jean-Baptiste Shandun is credible. Of course, all psychopaths are. Whoever else is indirectly involved has already vanished. You can count on that.
I don't know.
There are instructions about the Shandun cartel.
Oh, yes. There have been for a long time. Years. I did what I could while I was ATF down in Miami, but it wasn't working. Rules.
That's right. You and rules, Berger says coldly.
Until Rocco, I have been ineffective.
Well, you certainly were effective this time.
Tell me something, Lucy. Do you think you'll get away with it?
Yes.
You and Rudy made mistakes, Berger says. You left your tactical baton and had to go back to get it, and you were seen by several people. Never good, never good. And you staged the death scene quite expertly, quite cleverly, maybe too expertly, too cleverly. I would wonder about a room, a gun, a champagne bottle, etc., so clean that only Rocco's fingerprints are on them. I would wonder about advanced decomposition that seems to conflict with time of death, and flies, so damn many flies. Blowflies aren't terribly fond of cool weather. In Europe, they're more accustomed to cooler weather, as low as 48 degrees. The common bluebottle variety blowfly. Of course, warmer temperatures are better.
You must have learned that from your Aunt Kay. She would be so proud of you.
You would wonder, Lucy gets back to mistakes.
You wonder about everything. That's why you're who you are.
Don't underestimate the Polish authorities and medical experts, Lucy. You may not have heard the last of this. And if anything points back to you, I can't help you. I have to consider this conversation privileged. Right now, I am your lawyer, not a prosecutor. It's a lie, but I will somehow live with it. But whoever has given you directives, I don't care how long ago, will not return your secret phone calls now, won't even know your name, will frown and shrug in some cabinet meeting or over drinks at the Palm, or worse, laugh it off. The story of some overzealous private investigator.
It won't happen like that.
Berger slowly turns around and grabs Lucy's wrists.
Are you so goddamn sure of yourself that you're stupid? How can anyone so smart be so stupid?
The blood rises to Lucy's cheeks.
The world is full of users. They'll seduce you into the most outrageous acts for the sake of liberty and justice for all, and then they dissolve like mist, prove to be fantasies.
You begin to wonder if they were ever real, and as you rot away in a federal prison somewhere, God forbid, or extradited to a foreign country, you will slowly but surely believe it was all a delusion, because everybody else believes you are delusional, some nutcase who committed murder because she was on some secret mission for the CIA, the FBI, the fucking Pentagon, Her Majesty's Secret Service, the Easter Bunny. Stop it, Lucy exclaims. It's not like that. Berger's hands move up to Lucy's shoulders. For the first time in your life, listen to someone. Lucy blinks back tears. Who? Berger demands to know. Who sent you on this goddamn horrific mission? Is it someone I know? Please stop it. I can't and won't ever tell you. There's so much... Jamie, you're better off not knowing. Please trust me. Jesus! Berger's grip lightens, but she doesn't let go of her. Jesus, Lucy. Look at you. You're shaking like a leaf. You can't do this. Lucy angrily steps away. I'm not a child. When you touch me... She steps back some more. When you touch me, it means something different. It still does. So don't, don't. I know what it means, Berger says. I'm sorry. 82. At 10 p.m., Scarpetta climbs out of a taxi in front of Jamie Berger's building. Still unable to reach her niece, Scarpetta is pricked by anxiety that has worsened with each call she has made. Lucy doesn't answer her apartment or her cell phone. One of her associates at her office said he doesn't know where she is. Scarpetta begins to think about her reckless, fire-breathing niece and contemplates the worst. Her ambivalence about Lucy's new career has not abated. Hers is an unregimented, dangerous, and highly secretive life that may suit her personality, but it frustrates Scarpetta and frightens her. She can be impossible to get hold of, and Scarpetta rarely knows what Lucy is doing. Inside Jamie Berger's luxurious high-rise, a doorman greets Scarpetta.
May I help you, ma'am?
Jamie Berger, Scarpetta replies. The penthouse. 83. Lucy is tempted to dash from the building when she realizes that her aunt is headed up in the elevator. Calm down, Berger says. She doesn't know I'm here, Lucy says, upset. I don't want her to know I'm here. I can't see her right now. You're going to have to see her at some point. May as well be now. But she doesn't know I'm here, Lucy repeats herself. What am I going to tell her? Berger gives her an odd look as they hover near the door, waiting for the sound of the elevator. Is the truth such a bad thing? Berger replies angrily. You could tell her that. Now and then, telling the truth is very therapeutic. I'm not a liar, Lucy says. That's one thing I'm not, unless it is for the sake of work, especially the undercover work. The problem is when the boundaries merge, Berger says as the elevator arrives. Go sit in the living room, as if Lucy is a child. Let me talk to her first. Berger's foyer is marble, a table scented with fresh flowers across from the spotless brass elevator. She hasn't seen Scarpetta in several years, and is dismayed when she walks out of the elevator. Kay Scarpetta looks exhausted, her suit badly wrinkled, her eyes anxious. Does anybody on Earth answer the phone anymore? She says first thing. I've tried Marino, Lucy, you. In your case, your line was busy and has been busy for an hour, so at least I assumed someone was home. I had it off the hook. I wanted no interruptions. This makes no sense to Scarpetta.
I'm so sorry to barge in on you like this. I'm frantic, Jamie.
I can tell. Before you come in, I want you to know that Lucy is here. She states this matter-of-factly. I didn't want to shock you, but I expect you are relieved. Not entirely. Her office stonewalled me, meaning Lucy did. Kay, please come in, Berger says. They walk into the living room. Hi. Lucy hugs her aunt. Her response is stiff. Why are you treating me like this? She asks, not caring if Berger hears. Treating you like what? Lucy returns to the living room and sits on the couch. Come on. She motions for Scarpetta to join her. You too, Jamie. Not unless you're going to tell her, Berger says. Otherwise, I want no part in the conversation.
Tell me what?
Scarpetta sits next to Lucy.
Tell me what, Lucy?
I guess you've heard that Rocco Caggiano allegedly committed suicide in Poland, Berger tells her.
I haven't heard any news today about anything, Scarpetta replies.
Was either on the phone or in a plane, then a taxi. Now I'm here. What do you mean, allegedly?
Lucy stares down at her feet and says nothing.
Berger stands at the edge of the living room and is silent.
You disappeared for days.
No one would tell me where you were, Scarpetta begins quietly.
Were you in Poland?
A long pause, then Lucy lifts her eyes.
Yes, I was.
Dear God, Scarpetta mutters.
Alleged suicide, she repeats.
Lucy explains the tip about the murdered journalists that Shandon divulged to her in a letter. She explains further information from him about Rocco's whereabouts. Then she tells her aunt about the red notice.
So Rudy and I found him. Found him in the hotel he always stays in when he does his dirty business in Szczecin. We told him about the red notice, and he knew that was it. The end. Because, apprehended or not, the Shanduns would make sure he didn't live very long.
So he killed himself, Scarpetta says, looking straight into Lucy's eyes, searching them. Lucy doesn't reply. Berger walks out of the room.
Interpol has posted the information, Lucy then says, somewhat inanely. The police say his death is a suicide.
This appeases Scarpetta temporarily, only because she doesn't have the strength to probe further. She opens her briefcase and shows Lucy the letter from Shandon, and then Lucy goes into Berger's office.
Please come, Lucy starts to say.
No, Berger replies, the look in her eyes one of disappointment, of judgment.
How can you lie to her?
I didn't, and I haven't.
By omission. The whole truth, Lucy.
I'll get there, when it's time.
Shandon wrote her. You've got to see it. There's something really bizarre going on.
There sure is.
Berger gets up from her desk.
They return to the living room and look at the letter and envelopes through their protective plastic.
That's not like the letter I got, Lucy says immediately. It was block printing. It wasn't mailed regular post.
I guess Rocco mailed it for him. Rocco mailed a lot of things for him.
Why would Shandon write Marino and me in block printing?
What did the paper look like? Scarpetta asks.
Notebook paper, lined paper.
The paper in the prison commissary is plain white, 20-pound cheap stock. The same thing most of us use in our printers.
If he didn't send those letters to Marino and me, then who did?
Lucy feels sluggish, her system overloaded.
Based on the information in the letter to her, she orchestrated Rocco Caggiano's death. When she and Rudy held him hostage in the hotel room, Rocco never actually admitted to murdering the journalists.
Lucy recalls him rolling his eyes toward the ceiling, his only response. She can't know as fact what he really meant by that gesture. She can't know as fact that the information she sent to Interpol is correct. What she offered was enough for an arrest, but not necessarily a conviction, because in fact, Lucy doesn't know the facts. Did Rocco really meet with the two journalists mere hours before their murders? Even if he did, was he the one who shot them?
Lucy is responsible for the red notice. The red notice is why Rocco knew his life was over, no matter what he confessed or didn't confess. He became a fugitive, and if Lucy and Rudy hadn't brought about his death, the Shanduns would have. He should be dead. He needed to be dead. Lucy tells herself the world is better off because Rocco isn't in it.
Who wrote me that goddamn letter? Lucy says. Who wrote the one to Marino and the first one to you?
She looks at Scarpetta.
The ones that came in those National Academy of Justice postage paid envelopes? They sound like they were written by Shandon.
I agree with that, Scarpetta says. And the coroner in Baton Rouge got one, too.
Maybe Shandon changed his handwriting and paper when he wrote this one.
Lucy indicates the letter with its beautiful calligraphy.
Maybe the bastard's not in prison at all.
I heard about the phone calls to your office.
Zack got hold of me on my cell phone. I think we can't assume at all that Sean Dunn is still in prison, Scarpetta replies. Seems to me, Berger says, that he wouldn't have access to lined paper or National Academy of Justice envelopes if he's still in prison. How hard do you suppose it would be to create facsimiles of those postage-paid envelopes on a computer? God, I feel so stupid, Lucy says. I can't tell you what I feel. Of course it could be done. Just scan in an envelope, then type in the address you want, and print it on the same type of envelope. I could do it in 5 minutes. Berger looks at her for a long time. Did you, Lucy? She is stunned. Me do it? Why would I do it? You just admitted that you could, Berger somberly says.
It appears you're quite capable of doing a lot of things, Lucy. And it's convenient that information in the letter to you resulted in your going to Poland to find Rocco, who is now dead. I'm leaving the room. The prosecutor in me doesn't want to hear either any further lies or confessions. If you and your aunt want to talk for a while, please help yourselves. I have to put the phone back on the hook. I have calls to make. I haven't lied, Lucy says.
84. Sit down, Scarpetta says, as if Lucy is no longer a grown-up. The lights are out in the living room, and the New York skyline surrounds them with its brilliant possibilities and soaring power. Scarpetta could stare at it for hours, the way she does the sea. Lucy sits next to her on Berger's couch. This is a good place to be, Scarpetta says, gazing out at millions of lights. She looks for the moon, but can't find it behind buildings. Lucy is quietly crying. I've often wondered, Lucy, what would have happened had I been your real mother. Would you have adopted such a dangerous world and stormed through it so brazenly, so outrageously, so stunningly? Or would you be married with children? I think you know the answer to that, Lucy mutters, wiping her eyes. Maybe you would have been a Rhodes Scholar, gone to Oxford and become a famous poet. Lucy looks at her to see if she's joking. She's not. A gentler life, her aunt says softly. I raised you, or better stated, I attended to you as best I could, and I can't imagine loving any child more than I did and do love you. But through my eyes you found the ugliness in the world. Through your eyes I found decency, humanity, and justice, Lucy replies. I wouldn't change anything. Then why are you crying? She picks out distant plains glowing like small planets. I don't know. Scarpetta smiles. That's what you used to say when you were a little girl. Whenever you were sad and I'd ask you why, you'd say, I don't know. Therefore, my very astute diagnosis is that you are sad. Lucy wipes more tears from her face. I don't know exactly what happened in Poland, her aunt then says. Shifting her position on the couch, Scarpetta arranges pillows behind her back, as if inviting a long story. She continues to look past Lucy, out windows into the glittering night, because it is harder for people to have difficult conversations while they are looking at each other. I don't need you to tell me, but I think you need to tell me, Lucy. Her niece stares out at the city crowded around them. She thinks of dark high seas and ships lit up. Ships mean ports, and ports mean the Sean Dunns. Ports are the arteries for their criminal commerce. Rocco may have been only one vessel, but his connection to Scarpetta, to all of them, had to be severed. Yes, it had to be. Please forgive me, Aunt Kay. Please say it's all right. Please don't lose your respect for me and think I've become one of them. Ever since Benton died, you've been a fury, a spirit of punishment, and there isn't enough power in this entire city to satisfy your hunger for it, Scarpetta talks on, still gently. This is a good place for you to be, she says, as both of them stare out at the lights of the most powerful city on Earth. Because one of these days, when you're glutted with power, maybe you'll realize that too much of it is unbearable. You say that to explain yourself, Lucy comments, with no trace of rancor. You were the most powerful medical examiner in the country, perhaps in the world. You were the chief. Maybe it was unbearable, that power and admiration. Lucy's beautiful face is not quite as sad now. So much has seemed unbearable, Scarpetta replies. So much. But no, I didn't find my power unbearable when I was the chief. I have found losing my power unbearable. You and I feel differently about power. I am not proving anything. You are always proving something when it is so unnecessary. You haven't lost it, Lucy tells her. Your removal from power was an illusion, politics. Your true power has never been imposed by the outside world, and it follows that the outside world can't take it away from you. What has Benton done to us? Her question startles Lucy, as if Scarpetta somehow knows the truth. Since he died... I still can scarcely bring myself to say that word. Died. She pauses. Since then it seems the rest of us have gone to ruin. Like a country under siege, one city falling after another. You, Marino, me. Mostly you. Yes, I am a fury. Lucy gets up, moves to the window, and sits cross-legged on Jamie Berger's splendid antique rug. I am the Avenger, I admit it. I feel the world is safer, that you are safer, all of us are safer, with Rocco dead. But you can't play God. You're not even a sworn law enforcement officer anymore, Lucy. The last precinct is private. Not exactly. We are a satellite of international law enforcement. Work with them, usually behind the curtain of Interpol. We are empowered by other high authorities I can't talk to you about. A high authority that empowered you to legally rid the world of Rocco Caggiano? Scarpetta asks. Did you pull the trigger, Lucy? I need to know that, at least that. Lucy shakes her head. No, she didn't pull the trigger. Only because Rudy insisted on firing that round and having gunpowder and tiny drops of Rocco's blood blow back on his hands, not hers. Rocco's blood on Rudy's hands. That wasn't fair, Lucy tells her aunt. I shouldn't have allowed Rudy to put himself through that. I take equal responsibility for Rocco's death. Actually, I take full responsibility because it was by my instigation that Rudy went on the mission to Poland. They talk until late, and when Lucy has relayed all that happened in Szczecin, she awaits her aunt's condemnation. The worst punishment would be exile from Scarpetta's life, just as Benton has been exiled from it. I'm relieved that Rocco's dead, Scarpetta says. What's done is done, she adds. At some point, Marino will want to know what really happened to his son. 85. Dr. Lanier sounds as if he is on the mend, but he is as taut as a cocked catapult. You got a safe place for me to stay down there? Scarpetta asks him over the phone inside her single room at the Melrose Hotel at 63rd and Lexington. She opted not to spend the night with Lucy, resisting her niece's persistent urging. Staying with her would make it impossible for Scarpetta to leave for the airport in the morning without Lucy's knowing.
The safest place in Louisiana. My guest house. It's small. Why? Now you know I can't afford consultants.
Listen, she cuts him off. I've got to go to Houston first. She avoids being specific. I can't get down your way for at least another day.
I'll pick you up. Just tell me when.
If you could arrange a rental car for me, that's what would work best. I have no idea about anything right now. I'm too tired. But I'd rather take care of myself and not inconvenience you. I just need directions to your house. She writes them down. They seem simple enough.
Any particular kind of car?
A safe one.
I know all about that, the coroner replies. I've peeled enough people out of unsafe cars. I'll get my secretary on it first thing.
86. Trixie leans against the counter, smoking a menthol cigarette and glumly watching Marino pack a large ice chest with beer, luncheon meats, bottles of mustard and mayonnaise, and whatever his huge hands grab out of the refrigerator.
It's way past midnight, Trixie complains, fumbling for a bottle of Corona in a long-neck bottle that she clogged by stuffing in too large a slice of lime. Come on to bed and then you can leave, can't you? Don't that make more sense than zooming out of here half-lit and all upset in the middle of the night?
Marino has been drunk since he returned from Boston, sitting in front of the TV, refusing to answer the phone, refusing to talk to anyone, not even to Lucy or Scarpetta. About an hour ago, he was kicked hard by a message on his cell phone from Lucy's office. That sobered him enough to pry him out of his reclining chair.
Trixie holds the bottle straight up and tries to push the lime away with her tongue. She succeeds, and beer gushes into her mouth and over her chin. Not so long ago, Marina would have found this hilarious. Now nothing will make him smile. He jerks open the freezer door, pulling out the container of ice cubes and dumping them into the chest. Trixie, whose real name is Teresa, is 30 years old, and not even a year ago moved into Marino's small house in its blue-collar neighborhood, right off Midlothian Turnpike on the wrong side of the James River in Richmond. He lights a cigarette and looks at her face puffy from booze, the mascara so chronically smeared under her eyes that it looks tattooed on. Her platinum hair has been scalded by so many treatments that Marino hates to touch it, told her once when he was drunk that it felt like insulation. Some of her hurt feelings are permanently crippled, and when Marino catches a glimpse of them hobbling out of her eyes or mouth, he leaves the room, either with his thoughts or his feet.
"Please don't go."
Trixie sucks hard on a cigarette and shoots the smoke out of the side of her mouth, barely inhaling.
"I know what you're doing. You ain't coming back, that's what. I saw what you've been packing in your truck.
Guns, your bowling ball, even your trophies and fishing poles. Not to mention your usual clothes. Nothing nice like those suits that have been hanging in the closet since Jesus wrote the Ten Commandments." She steps in front of him and grabs his arm as he rearranges ice in the chest, smoke making him squint.
"I'll call you. I've got to get to Louisiana, and you know it. The doc's down there, or is about to be down there. I know her. I know damn well what she's gonna do. She don't have to tell me. You don't want her dead, Trixie."
"I'm so fucking tired of the doc this and the doc that."
Her face darkens, and she shoves Marino's hand away as if touching had been his idea, not hers.
"Ever since I've known you, it's been the doc this and the doc that.
She's the only woman in your life, if you're honest about it.
I'm just the second draft choice in your basketball game of life."
Marino winces. He can't stand Trixie's colorful near-miss expressions, which remind him of a piano out of tune.
"I'm just the girl who sits out the dance in the prom that is your life,"
she continues the drama, and by now that's all it is. A drama, like a bad soap opera. Their fights are by rote for the most part, and although Marino has a special aversion to psychology, not even he can avoid an insight as big as a mountain. He and Trixie fight about everything because they fight about nothing. Her fat bare feet with their chipped red-painted nails pat across the kitchen as she paces, wildly waving her plump arms, cigarette ashes snowing down on the stained linoleum floor.
"Well, you just go on to Louisiana and get with the doc this and that, and by the time you come back, if you ever do, maybe someone else will be living in this dump of yours, and I'll be gone. 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 Gone."
Half an hour ago, Marino asked her to put his house on the market. She can live in it until it sells. Her flower-printed acetate robe flutters around her feet as she paces, her breast sagging over the sash she keeps tightening around her thick waist. Marino feels pangs of anger and guilt. When Trixie nags him about Scarpetta, he flies out of control like a pissed-off bird out of a knothole with no place to go, no way to defend himself, no way to counterattack, not really. His wounded ego can't be assuaged by implying indiscretions with Scarpetta that unfortunately have never occurred. So the arrows of the jealous Trixies in his life find their spot and draw their blood. Marino isn't bothered that he's lost every woman he's ever had. He's bothered by the one he never got, and Trixie's tantrum is mounting dangerously close to the necessary crescendo that will bring about the necessary coda.
"You're so crazy for her, it's disgusting," Trixie yells. "You're nothing but a big redneck to her. That's all you'll ever be. A big, fat, stupid redneck," she shrieks. "And I don't care if she ends up dead. Dead is all she knows anyhow."
Marino picks up the ice chest as if it weighs nothing and walks through his shabby, cluttered living room and stops at the front door. He looks around at the 36-inch color TV. Not a new one, but a Sony, and plenty nice. He stares sadly at his favorite reclining chair, where it seems he has spent most of his life, and he feels an ache so deep it's a cramp in his bowels. He imagines how many hours he has spent half-drunk watching football and wasting his time and efforts on the likes of Trixie. She's not a bad woman. She's not evil. None of them have been. They're simply pitiful.
and he is even more pitiful than any of them because he has never insisted on more for himself, and he could have.
"I won't be calling you after all," Marino tells her. "I don't even give a rat's ass what happens to the house. Sell it, rent it, live in it."
"You don't mean that, baby,"
Trixie begins to cry.
"I love you."
"You don't know me,"
Marino says from the door, and he feels too tired to leave and too depressed to stay.
"Course I do, baby."
She crushes out a cigarette in the sink and rummages in the refrigerator for another beer.
"And you're gonna miss me."
Her face twists as she smiles, crying at the same time.
"And you'll get your ass back here. I was just mad when I said you wouldn't. You will."
She pops off the bottle cap.
"One reason I know you'll be back is..."
"What?" She points coyly at him.
"Can you guess what Detective Trixie noticed, huh? You're leaving without your Christmas decorations. All those millions of plastic Santas, reindeer, snowmen, jalapeno pepper lights, and the rest of what you've been collecting for a century? And you're going to drive off and just leave them in the basement? Nuh-uh. No way. Nuh-uh."
She talks herself into believing she's right. Marino wouldn't leave for good and not pack up his beloved Christmas decorations.
"Rocco's dead," he says.
"Who?"
Trixie's face goes blank.
"See? That's what I mean. You don't know me," he says. "It's all right. It ain't your fault."
He shuts the door on her. Shuts the door on Richmond for good.
This book is continued on Disc 8.